Today is Monday, November the 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington. Coming up, in Hong Kong, an election with record turnout handed a big victory to pro-democracy candidates.
You have 4.1 million registered voters here in Hong Kong. Nearly 3 million of them went out and casted votes. Compare that to 47% in 2015. It's an incredible number.
Also ahead, legal experts say that a court ruling expected today could give cover to administration officials to cooperate in the impeachment inquiry against U.S. President Donald Trump. It's all on today's International Edition. This week, the House Intelligence Committee and two other panels are working on a report that could be the basis of articles of impeachment. Democratic sources say that the House could possibly vote to impeach Trump by late December. Also, a judge will decide today on whether former White House counsel Don McGahn must testify about President Trump to Congress. So, going forward, what does this mean? For this, we have our congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson joining me here in studio. Hello, Catherine. Thank you for joining us.
You're so welcome.
So, Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff says that this weekend that more depositions and hearings related to the impeachment probe are possible. Is he waiting on this court ruling?
It's possible entirely that he is indeed waiting for this court ruling that we know will have serious implications for whether or not Democrats can force administration officials to come before them and testify in this Trump impeachment Ukraine probe. Also, I think that Schiff wants to leave his options open as they're writing this report. Remember, when the House Intelligence Committee releases this report, it then goes to the House Judiciary Committee, which traditionally handles impeachment proceedings for U.S. presidents.
Now, we learned that an associate to President Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, is saying that he's prepared to testify that aides to Representative Devin Nunes that they dropped a planned trip to Ukraine to obtain dirt on former Vice President Joe Biden in order to avoid alerting Chairman Adam Schiff. Now, at this point, do we know if or when Lev Parnas is scheduled to appear, and how important would his testimony be?
Well, we don't have any scheduling quite yet, and we also do know, of course, that Representative Devin Nunes, who is the highest-ranking Republican on the House Intelligence Committee, has called these allegations demonstrably false in an interview with a conservative news source. He, of course, is a very, very strong supporter of President Trump and was, you know, before the media quite often last week talking about some of these so-called conspiracy theories that Ukraine interfered in the 2016 election, and that's why President Trump was concerned about allegations of corruption there.
Now, going back to this court ruling that is expected today, which other administration officials are likely to appear before the committee?
This is a whole range of officials. Mick Mulvaney, you could also see a subpoena for Secretary of State Mike Pompeo following those allegations from Gordon Sondland, the U.S. ambassador to the EU, that came out in public hearings last week. We have a whole range of subpoenas that are just waiting. But also remember that House Democrats have also said that they don't want to be bogged down in the courts. They do want to get this impeachment vote out as soon as possible before the public tires of this discussion.
That's regardless of any additional testimonies.
Correct. Absolutely.
Now, what is the mood like in Washington going into the holiday season, and is that likely to change?
Well, I think that really up on Capitol Hill, at least, it's been one of exhaustion. You're talking about 12 witnesses in 5 days, 31 hours of testimony. This was an intense 2 weeks. We kind of went through impeachment, the fast track in previous presidential impeachments. It's been months of hearings. So because we're moving into a 2020 presidential election, the timeline for all of this is accelerated. So everyone up here is exhausted, and I would say that happy to have a little bit of a holiday break.
Right. And before I let you go, I wanted to tell what can you tell us about this report that a White House review turned out emails that show efforts to justify President Trump's decision to block military aid to Ukraine.
That's right. So this is again where Mick Mulvaney is being pulled into this impeachment probe. He was in charge of finding a justification for the holdup in the aid. And that's interesting because we've also heard from House Republicans that this kind of, you know, holdup in aid is standard and that they were waiting to see if Ukraine's president was indeed a reliable partner and would address the issues of corruption.
That was VOA's congressional correspondent, Catherine Gibson. She joined me here in the studio. Thank you, Catherine.
You're so welcome.
Defense Secretary Mark Esper demanded the resignation of the Navy's top civilian leader, Richard V. Spencer, a move aimed at ending a dispute between President Trump and the senior U.S. military leadership over the fate of a SEAL commando in a war military crimes case. VOA's national security correspondent Jeff Selden is at the Pentagon. He joins me via phone for more on the story. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, good to be here.
Defense Secretary Mark Esper demanded the resignation of the Navy's top civilian leader on Sunday. What reason did he give?
He said he came out and he spoke to reporters early on Monday this morning, and he listed additional reasons. He said that basically the highest-ranking civilian in the Navy, Richard Spencer, broke the rules of when it comes to the chain of command, and that Spencer had gone around both the Defense Secretary Esper and the highest-ranking military officer, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, to broker a deal with the White House so that the White House would get what it wants in that this former or this still current Navy SEAL, Eddie Gallagher, would be allowed to retire as a member of the elite unit, keeping his rank and basically bypassing a border review that Gallagher was supposed to go before in coming days to determine whether or not that would be allowed. Now, remember, Eddie Gallagher is a controversial figure. He was a Navy SEAL accused of war crimes. The trial had lots of different aspects, things that were very strange according to both the prosecution and the defense, and ultimately was acquitted of most of the charges, although he was convicted of posing by breaking rules and posing with a dead body. The president has chimed in. President Trump has spoken about this case numerous times, most recently saying that Eddie Gallagher should be he pardoned Eddie Gallagher of the crimes of which he was convicted, and said he should be allowed to retire as a member of the SEALs, keep his trident pin, which signifies that. And Esper says none of this really makes sense about why Spencer would go behind his back to make this happen. And therefore, because of that violation of trust, he asked for Spencer's resignation, and Spencer gave it. The interesting thing is that what Spencer said in his letter of resignation, or his acknowledging that he was fired, said that he couldn't go along with the decision because Gallagher needed to go before the review board, and that he no longer saw eye to eye with the president on how to fulfill his oath of office, and therefore he needed to step back.
Now, is there a precedent for this kind of situation where the president injects himself in a case of this nature?
Well, the defense secretary, Mark Esper, pointed out to reporters today that the president, in ordering that Eddie Gallagher be allowed to be reinstated to his initial rank, be allowed to retire as a member of the elite SEALs unit with his trident pin at that rate of pay, that the president was acting well within his authority and privilege and his rights. Now, so he says that's allowed. At the same time, the defense secretary said that he and other members of the Pentagon's top ranks had been committed to allowing the military justice process as it's designed to play out, which in this case the president decided wasn't going to happen.
So did Richard Spencer resign, or was he fired, or did they fire him after he threatened to resign?
There are arguments about that. The Navy Secretary, Richard Spencer, was actually at a defense conference in Halifax, Canada, over the weekend, in which he denied that he threatened to resign. But today we heard from the defense secretary that Spencer told him that should they go ahead with the president's wishes, and the president order them to allow Gallagher to retire as a member of the SEALs, that he would be forced to quit. And Esper said he took that as a threat to resign. And so there are disagreements over that. But Esper also said while he lost trust and confidence in Spencer for trying to arrange for a deal behind his back, the deal itself and the reasons why Spencer said that he could not go ahead with the president's order don't make any sense. Spencer said he couldn't, in good faith, he couldn't allow Gallagher to retire without going before the review board, but yet he's accused of arranging a deal to basically do an end around the review board and get the president what he wanted. Esper said that would have forced somebody within the chain of command to compromise their integrity, and he wasn't okay with that.
Right.
But still, lots of questions about this very complicated case.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jeff. That was VOA's national security correspondent, Jeff Selden. Thank you, Jeff.
Anytime.
This is VOA News. Among the top stories in the world, Tanzania summoned Canada's envoy to protest after an aircraft set to be delivered to state-owned Air Tanzania was impounded in a land compensation dispute. And Pope Francis voiced concern about nuclear power Monday after meeting with victims of Japan's 2011 nuclear disaster, saying that development of future energy sources must take environmental consideration into account. In Hong Kong, a record turnout delivered the pro-democracy camp more than 80% of contested seats, the biggest electoral victory for the movement since Hong Kong's handover from British rule in 1997. Reporter Justin Solomon is in the Chinese city, spoke to me earlier today.
You know, despite the unrest that has been facing Hong Kong over the last, 5 to 6 months, everything ran relatively smooth. The voter turnout was incredible. It was at about 71%. So you have 4.1 million registered voters here in Hong Kong. Nearly 3 million of them went out and casted votes. Compare that to 47% in 2015. It's an incredible number.
And looking at some of these numbers, overwhelming win for pro-democracy protesters, what does this mean for the administration in Hong Kong, but also in Beijing?
Well, I mean, so if you take a look at the numbers where you see that the pro-democracy candidates took nearly 350 seats of the 452 that were up for grabs, it sends a clear message that the protesters came out and they protested with their votes, and they're sending a clear message, and they're showing that they are in the majority, which goes against what I think Beijing had been thinking and had been saying at times. So what does this mean? Well, there definitely will be a shakeup, I would assume, within the Hong Kong government. What that looks like, I think no one really knows yet. Today, Carrie Lam, the leader of Hong Kong, issued a statement saying the government of Hong Kong will listen to the opinions of members of public humbly and seriously reflect. So you can sort of take that as you will and then sort of read into that what you want.
Is there a likelihood of Beijing offering any new concessions in the coming days?
That's the million-dollar question. Will Beijing offer more concessions? Will the results of this election show that they need to do something? And no one really knows yet. Beijing has been relatively quiet since the results have come out. I suspect we'll hear from them in the coming days. We will hear from Carrie Lam tomorrow, Tuesday morning, when she delivers her weekly press conference. The protesters are saying this, even though that they came out and they won these elections, they still are demanding their five demands. They will continue to protest until they get what they want.
These are district elections. What do they mean? Do they even really matter in the grand scheme of things?
That's a great question, and they are just district elections, and that means they are district councillors that deal with local issues, bus schedules, road repairs, things like that. But the party that wins the most seats out of these 452, which we now know is the pro-democracy camp, that party gets more seats on a committee which is responsible for electing the next chief executive of Hong Kong. So they'll most likely be rewarded with about 117 seats of, I think it's about 1,200 in all, that elects the next chief executive. So they really can make a difference for the future of Hong Kong.
But what's the word out of Beijing on these results, whether it's in official circles or in the media, how the election results are being covered?
Truthfully, I haven't seen too much from the from Beijing media or from mainland media yet. But what I can tell you is an official from Beijing was speaking in Japan, and it was pretty much the only comment I've seen thus far from Beijing. And he basically said, you need to remember that Hong Kong is part of China. And that was it. He left it at that, plain and simple. So reiterating the fact that Hong Kong is part of China, despite this pro-democracy movement that's happening here.
Is there something we can read out of that silence or that statement, non-statement?
I'd say they're probably trying to process this. I think there was an assumption that the pro-democracy movement would have a large victory in the election. I don't know if they assumed it would be this large, this much of a landslide. And I think they're probably thinking about how to respond to that and what to do. And going back to what Carrie Lam said earlier, the leader of Hong Kong, they respect the elections, she said. And there are various interpretations of that. That was also part of her statement. And they understand that it shows that people are dissatisfied with the situation and the deep-rooted problems in society here. And as Carrie Lam said, they will reflect on these results, and we'll hear more from we will hear more from them in the coming days.
That was reporter Justin Solomon. He spoke to me from Hong Kong. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. The ride-sharing service Uber has been stripped of its London operating license after the regulator found a pattern of failures on safety and security. This is the second time in just over 2 years that the company has lost its license in the city. Uber says that it plans to appeal this suspension. VOA's Henry Ridgewell is in London. I reached him for more on this story. So this decision to not extend Uber's taxi's operating license, how significant is this decision?
Well, this is the latest decision in a series of cases that Transport for London, the body that administers transport in the city, has taken against Uber. It has had its license suspended twice before, but then extended by TfL. This seems to be the end of the road for the process in terms of Transport for London, but what they're doing is leaving it up to the courts, essentially. So Uber has already said it will appeal this process in the courts, and it will be up to a judge to decide whether Uber is fit and proper to run taxis and cabs in London.
Now, does this decision mean that Uber ceases operation in the UK immediately?
No, it doesn't. The cars will stay on the streets of London. There are some 45,000 Uber drivers in the British capital. That makes it the fifth biggest market for the company. Those cars and those drivers will stay on the roads until that appeals process in the courts has played out. That could take weeks. It could take months. And don't forget, we're in a very busy period here in Britain politically, but also in the courts as well. They will break for Christmas. So it may be not until the new year that we get an answer.
And how does this decision affect people in London? Are there other ride-sharing companies operating in that space?
There are some. There are some similar app-based, mobile-based operators to Uber, but it does enjoy a very large share of the market here in the capital, and it is ubiquitous everywhere you go. You see people using it. If you open the app and you look at the number of cars around where you are, there is always really an Uber car within a few minutes, and a lot of people do rely on it. So if the license is suspended in a couple of weeks or months' time, then it will have an impact. But some analysts say that London is such a diverse and vibrant economy, they think other companies will quickly move to fill the void of mobile phone-based taxi hailing. Don't forget also as well, we've got the famous London black cabs as well, and you still see
hundreds, thousands of those on the streets of London, probably they would celebrate a ruling against Uber, because there has long been disquiet among the black cab community that Uber was able to come here and set up and potentially undermine their business so quickly.
Now, the transportation authorities in their decision say that Uber had persistent safety problems. Do they specifically say which problems?
Yes, they did, and they particularly noted a couple of discrepancies in the operation of Uber. Most of this surrounds the safety of the drivers and the vetting of the drivers, looking for criminal records and so on, and the process of suspending drivers. The Transport for London noted that some unauthorized drivers who didn't hold any license were able to upload photos of themselves onto existing Uber drivers' accounts. So you could be an Uber driver with a license, but let somebody else upload their photo so that license looks legitimate on the app, it looks legitimate to the authorities, but in fact the driver is masquerading and they don't have a license. And Transport for London say that because of that, 14,000 fraudulent trips were made in just a few months between December of last year and early this year. The second problem they noted was that once a driver had been either dismissed or suspended, that some were able to immediately launch new Uber accounts and relaunch themselves as new Uber drivers, perhaps unlicensed or uninsured. Uber, in response, has said this is very much the wrong decision. They say they're being held to a much higher safety bar than any other taxi operating company, and they say that they have audited all of their drivers within the last 2 months.
That was VOA's Henry Ridgewell. I reached him in London.
On December 5th, Border Crossings will bring you the greatest songs inspired by the soul genre. You'll hear smash hits from Three Dog Night, Holland Oates, and George Michael. If you like these tracks, you'll love our Soul Inspirations theme. December 5th on The Voice of America.
Coast-to-coast paddling protesters have taken to the ocean to demonstrate against the Norwegian mining company's plans to drill off of the South Australia. From Sydney, Phil Massa reports.
The Great Australian Bight is a wide-open bay off the continent's southern coastline. Conservationists say it's one of the most stunning marine environments in the world, with the planet's largest population of southern right whales. It's also home to sea lions, dolphins and penguins. It's also of interest to the resources industry. A Norwegian company, Equinor, wants to drill a well 370 kilometres from the coast in search of oil. There has been petroleum exploration in the Great Australian Bight since the late 1960s. The South Australian state government has said there's been no reported or identified environmental harm in the last 50 years. But never before has drilling taken place at a depth of more than 2 kilometres, which is what Equinor has proposed. Environmentalists on surfboards have held rallies around Australia. There were more than 50 so-called paddleouts, including at Port Lincoln in South Australia, Bondi Beach in Sydney, and Townsville in Queensland. There are fears about the potential for oil spills and damage to the local fishing and tourism sectors. Campaigners believe the oil exploration plan in the Australian Bight is too risky.
We're fighting for the Bight and we're trying to get Equinor out of our Australian marine waters.
Please, Equinor, follow the lead of BP and Chevron and pull out. The Australian people have said no.
The federal government says the project will improve Australia's energy security and bring money and jobs to the region. Matt Doman is from the Australian Petroleum Production and Exploration Association, an industry group. He says the drilling can be undertaken safely.
We understand there are a wide range of questions and concerns that exist in the community. We just urge a calm assessment, a fact-based assessment.
Earlier this month, Australia's offshore safety watchdog asked the Norwegian energy company to modify its drilling plan. Equinor said it's committed to meeting all regulatory requirements and intends to start exploration within 2 years. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You have been listening to International Edition. You can find more news at voanews.com. Like us on Facebook at VOA Now. Follow us on Twitter at VOAIE. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our producer Daniel Brown, our engineer John Drayden. I'm Jackson Vunganya in Washington. Have a great day, everyone.